Weekend Breakfast on 702. Let's walk the talk.
25 minutes to 7 o'clock, and talking now about Rhino and the Rhino Recovery Fund in our Nature Diary. Joining us is our nature enthusiast, Tim Neary. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Ray. Are you well this morning?
Not too bad. I'm glad we're talking about Rhino this morning. It's something that's been cropping up in Eyewitness News very, very often lately, and it's something we need to talk about.
Well, I think so, Ray, and I think we go back to somewhere around about, I think it was 2006 odd, where on this very program on the Sunday morning, we started talking about rhino poaching. And we were told by various parties that there was no rhino poaching, that it wasn't an issue, and that we would never have a rhino poaching issue. And obviously, I think we might have been right for once, or twice.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we're talking about it this morning. Joining us also is the Director of Wildlife Conservation at the Network for Rhino Recovery Fund, Dr. Marcus Hofmeyr. Hi, good morning, Doctor, and welcome.
Morning. How are you?
Lovely to have you on. Thank you. So, Tim, I'm going to start with you. Where are we when it comes to rhino poaching in this country? As I said in my introduction earlier, things are out of control. But where are we? Are we dehorning now so people are getting desperate?
Ray, I think that there are various issues that have got to be addressed with rhino poaching in South Africa. But I think what I find more interesting is to look at the Rhino Recovery Fund and see how it's working across the globe with rhino issues. And we look at things in sort of isolation in South Africa. And yeah, I guess the numbers, the vast areas that we have to work in, you know, it must be absolutely hell in somewhere like Kruger Park trying to manage a poaching issue if you've got rhinos scattered everywhere. I don't think we ever get a handle on it properly in this country. I don't know what went wrong. I don't know why we are unable to infiltrate things. That would be something for, I guess, the Minister of Police to talk about. But, you know, we just don't seem to ever nail kingpins. So if we can't nail kingpins, then do we not go the other direction? Turn poachers into protectors and have a look and see what do we do about raising the rhino numbers across the globe? Where are there safe areas for them to be moved to, etc.? And I think this is where the Rhino Recovery Fund comes in. And let's discover a little bit more about the work that Marcus and the fund does.
Yeah. Dr. Marcus Hofmeyr, do you want to take us through the fund, how it works, etc.?
Yeah, thank you very much for this opportunity, and agree that, you know, rhino conservation is complex. I'll quickly just give a brief synopsis on the background of that. It is a unique situation where you've got a mammal that's so successful in its evolution that it actually, before humans came along with sophisticated weapons, it didn't have many natural predators except when they were calves or when they were injured. So the main natural cause of death of rhinos is mostly killing each other, believe it or not, or natural disasters, and then obviously old age. So when we came along with weapons that you could remotely or even as a very relatively weak predator could overcome the defenses of a strong rhino, they haven't been able to evolve fast enough to really adapt to that. So that is why they need our help to protect them. And then you've got this very strange anomaly that their horn, which is just basically the same material as your fingernail, keratin, has become one of the most valuable natural resources out there. And, you know, it just shows you how effective criminal networks are at marketing something that really has no value otherwise. Mm. So from a Rhino Recovery Fund point of view, we one of the funds that falls under the WCN, Wildlife Conservation Network's fund programs. The other funds are with pangolin, elephant, and lion. And our objective is to really support projects wherever they are rhinos to recover them, focusing on three main areas. One is obviously trying to secure them where they are, protected area management in particular, which is very important because it's very expensive to look after rhinos because of the law enforcement component. Then we really are going to be trying to ramp up the component where we help prepare or support projects that are going to be reintroducing rhinos into new areas or into areas where they historically used to occur. And then we also you know, trying to find ways to tackle the illegal wildlife trade, which is a very sophisticated thing to do. And our funds are not of that nature where we can do it at a huge scale yet. There are other organizations that are doing a lot of good work in that. And in all of that, you know, the long-term objective is to make runners relevant to society at all levels. And that's where fundamentally in South Africa we've got a major problem. You know, it's not everybody feels that rhino are worth protecting. There are segments of society that feel that, you know, we place more emphasis on animals than on people. And, you know, if you start getting those sort of mixed emotions and conflicting attitudes, you know, it is unfortunately where crime then comes in and can exploit those polarized sort of situations. And then obviously poverty and lack of jobs. And if you've got an opportunity to make a lot of money quickly, and you've got no other opportunities, then you just sit with the situation, especially around cougar and umfolozi, where poaching is just almost out of control and very difficult to stop. And on top of that, in South Africa particularly, you've got huge amounts of corruption within all segments of government, including the police and the judiciary system. And if you have those all coming together, it's a perfect storm to make it very difficult to stop a crime that ends up with a poor species being threatened as it is.
Yeah.
So our objective is really to help as many projects as we can throughout the world. There are 5 species of rhinos, you know, 2 in Africa, 3 in Asia, to make sure that they don't go extinct and that we recover them as best we can.
Yeah. Tim, if you want to come in there as well.
Right. You know, when I listen to Marcus as well talking there, I think one of the things that just always fascinates me, man is the only creature on the farm that is not managed in any way. And man is the only creature who's able to decide that, you know, something like a rhino, a link in the chain, simply has no value. And I've, you know, and I'm not talking about its horn value. I'm talking about its ecosystem services value. And I find that very sad. You know, and I don't know quite how we attach that or attack that sort of message. Marcus, you mentioned moving animals, you mentioned reintroductions, etc. You've just done a huge reintroduction, though, into Rwanda, 30-odd animals. How complex is it doing that, and how easy is it to do a move like that? And, of course, I guess you've got to now start worrying about, the poaching aspect and the breeding aspect of those animals.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I mean, the move to Rwanda, I was a guest on that, helping with the actual transportation. The project was coordinated by African Parks and Sector Victories Conservation Solutions. They are really, together with Frankfurt Zoological Society, partnering with governments throughout Africa to secure other areas that have been neglected, conservation areas, or trying to build new collective projects that can save environments where there was historically a protected area. And they're doing a very good job in most areas that they're doing. And Rwanda is a very interesting country. They're one of the few countries in Africa where things have turned around incredibly well. I was blown away, and anybody in Africa who has an opportunity to go there should go there, given the history that country's had. So there's a strong political will. You've got a strong government NGO partnership, and then obviously a group like Conservation Solutions, Sector Victory, who's now got huge amounts of experience of doing complex international transportation, who then can do something like this. And I mean, it's the largest single transportation and the largest aerial lift of rhinos in one go that's ever been done in the world. And it took months and months of planning. So it took first to catch the rhinos. They all came from Pinda and Northern KwaZulu-Natal, and beyond, and their conservation team were very generous to donate some of the rhinos, and obviously happy to generate some income from the investments they're making there. They were put into small camps for a couple of months, just to acclimatize them to being in camps, and then they were all loaded in 3 hours, which is a huge task for anybody who does rhino capture, and then transferred to the Durban International, Shaka Durban International Airport, and then loaded into a 747 cargo plane.
Sure.
To Kigali, transferred to trucks, and then they were to take it to 2 different camps, one in the north of Akagera National Park and one in the south. So very similar conditions to where they were held for a couple of months before they were left, and they're now in the process of being released. So incredibly smooth, but again, these type of things take immense amounts of planning. It's not cheap. And kudos to the whole team that put this all together.
How easily do they settle down once they've gone into a new area like that, Marcus? Do they, you know, and when I say settle down, get to the point where they're quite happy to get into a breeding motion, etc.?
Yeah, so white runners, fortunately, are fairly easy to translocate if you put them into habitat that's good for them. And Apagera is an interesting park. It's unfortunately been reduced in its size after the genocide that happened there. But it's very similar to Umfolozi Shishlui, sort of almost like the Umfolozi Shishlui on steroids, because there's a lot of fertile soil there near the tropics. So if you put them into a habitat where there's good grass and water available, they adapt very quickly. So the hurdle they have to overcome there is they're going into a high density sticky fly which transmits trypanosomiasis, and they've been treated prophylactically. They're in smaller camps where there's lots of targets. So there's a process that you have to follow to release them to make sure that it's successful. And with any translocation, there's always a risk that something goes wrong. But as long as the percentage of translocation or post-release losses are small, the risks are worth taking, because in a 2 or 3 or 5 years' time when they're breeding and they've established those few losses that you do have, and there haven't been any so far, it makes it totally worth it. And that's now a new East African population that can, if they breed well, can serve as a source for other translocations in that region. Because the only other area where there's white runner in East Africa is in Kenya.
How safe are they there, Dr. Marcus? In comparison to, say, South Africa, if they are going to breed them there, is there a poaching problem in Rwanda? If not, why not?
So, Akagera National Parks, the African Parks Network, have reintroduced black rhino already in 2017 and 2018, and they're doing very well. Rwanda is a very peaceful country at the moment, and very strong law enforcement, strong political will. There's no way that if anybody poaches a rhino there, that will go left unattended and muddled with corruption. So from that perspective, I think they've got probably, with the current leadership, with the current setup that they've got there, very small chance that it will be a huge risk. And if there is a poaching event, there will probably be a very strong reaction from all levels of government to deal with it. So that's a very strong deterrent for anything to happen to rhinos. It's not a guarantee that it will always be like that, but you have to work on it. But African Parks have put together a very strong security network. They have been in the region now, I think, for almost 10 years. And so far, poaching is pretty much non-existent in the park. A little bit of snaring historically, but none anymore. So I'm confident that they will be safe there. And given the trajectory of Rwanda and its development, I think that's one of the few countries where they're definitely going to be safer than most other countries.
Sure, Tim, that is good news.
That is, and I think the more that I hear of Rwanda, the more I need to book a ticket, because if you look at what they do in pollution, etc., they've got a pretty good handle, and there's a hell of a lot that South Africa could learn from the way that they do things. And I guess also that having people like the guys looking after the parks, and have been for 10 years, it's recognized that they're bringing money into the country, they're bringing employment, and I think there's most probably an appreciation of that as well. Marcus, you mentioned that rhino, not cheap to move, not cheap to manage, etc. How on earth do you go about raising funds to move 30 rhino? Because that's not sort of chump change and something you're going to haul out your back pocket or pay with a credit card.
Yeah, so these type of projects, does require advanced money. You can't just plan it and sort of wing it when you get to it. You have to make sure you've got the committed funding in the bank. International transfers generally cost, 10 to 100 times more than a national transfer, because you need to, have cross-border permits. You have to fly animals, which is expensive. I mean, the flight alone was probably in the region of $300,000. You have to make sure that the runners are caught in time. So this particular program was sponsored by Howard Buffett, who has a good relationship with many organizations, not only conservation, but various other philanthropic support that he gives in the world. And African Parks, they're just very efficient in what they're doing and are quite successful at raising money, particularly philanthropy money. And then obviously the government themselves have put in quite a bit of funding from their side to support the sort of behind-the-scenes logistics making sure all the wheels turn properly. But this is a challenge, and, you know, being in charge of the runner recovery fund, you know, trying to fundraise for runners is not that easy. They're not charismatic like lions or elephants that people often easily give money to. And there is a bit of fatigue setting in because, particularly in South Africa, there hasn't been a solution to the poaching problem. So people are thinking, well, where's my dollar actually going to? So it's very important for everybody in conservation to realize that, you know, funding is not limitless. You have to make sure that you have some sort of success.
Yeah.
And again, if we can turn the story about rhinos around, not make them this like highly protected species that only survives if you've got a military force around them, to something that everybody in the country really wants to protect, then the cost dynamics change and the investments can also go towards people living in and around where rhinos occur. And that is the long-term solution, in my opinion. And it will be then easier to unlock different money as well, not just the odd philanthropist and tourism-related funding that links it to conservation. It's really critical that we do that.
With that, Dr. Marcus, Sanparks, what's their relationship with you? Do they work with you, or what's the combined effort?
So, as you know, I used to work for Sanparks, and they're still doing a phenomenal job where they can. The people on the ground are working absolutely incredibly hard. The rangers are you know, really working around the clock to so the runners get in Kruger. We also have to make a mention here that the other parks of Sanparks, Marikele, Addo National Park, Mountain Zebra, Karoo National Park, where they're also runners, have not lost the same amount of runners. So there has been some success in Sanparks. With regards to that, the biggest southwestern black runner population occurs in Addo National Park, and they haven't lost a single runner to poaching. So it's not all doom and gloom. It's particularly Kruger and the area and the socio-political environment in that environment that's making it very difficult to get on top of it. So I'm not working directly with Sanparks, but obviously there are officials in Sanparks that we speak to regularly, who are all part of the African Runner Specialist Group. And then there is some support to try and find ways to understand what the best method of dealing with this issue is and supporting them in that way.
Yeah.
But Sanparks, yeah, they are, you know, they're sitting in a very difficult situation regarding funding. There's bureaucratic processes which inhibit them from being very efficient. And these are all things that the officials on the ground have to endure, plus the criticism of the public that they're not doing a good job. So, you know, I do want to sympathize with those honest, non-corrupt officials that are doing such a fantastic job.
Marcus, you mentioned the word charismatic here. Now, to me, Imbrano is fairly charismatic, and funny enough, I've watched them at Pinda where they reverse their backsides into the dam so that the terrapins come up and start help clean off ticks and all sorts of things. How does one go about making this more charismatic and getting people to understand that the rhino is a link in the chain, that it does offer ecosystem services on grass distributions, etc., in a national park or in a park or in an area? And it doesn't need to have a value to ensure that it's allowed to continue on the planet. How does one change that?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways of doing it. It's changing the narrative around runners. Firstly, they're not a conflict species like lion and elephant are in many areas of that. So if you look at elephant and lion, they're very charismatic. But if you go to Botswana or Kenya or Tanzania or any country where their numbers are doing quite well. They're not necessarily that well liked by local populations or communities because they create livelihood threats. Whereas rhinos tend not to do that. So again, it's putting that in a picture that people can appreciate. And I think that the problem with rhinos is that it's associated with strong anti-poaching activities, military forces, and all that type of thing. And if you're a community member living next to a park, you know, if you don't get exposed to something positive related to rhinos, you're never going to have a positive attitude towards it. And those are the very people we need to change the attitude and have them feel proud and related to the animal that they would want to protect it, even if they're not necessarily directly getting an income or an opportunity from it. So it's a very difficult thing to do, but I think it's the way we talk about it, the way we go about presenting them. And for me, the sort of final sort of statement I'd like to make on this is that rhinos can only survive, like pangolins, another prehistoric mammal, if we as people literally decide that you're going to make sure that they survive. They will not survive on their own if we don't set that social environment up for them, because they put no defenses against us or the criminals that are trying to steal them or the products that they have on their bodies.
Yeah, it certainly is a massive, massive problem. And you're right, Dr. Marcus Hofmeyr. We need to have a concerted effort from government as well, a buy-in from the public. I can only think, Tim, that when it comes to rhino and rhino horn, maybe an education program in the East, I'm talking about the Southeast Asian countries, that rhino horn doesn't do that actually. Like you said, it's just your fingernail.
Yeah, right. I think we can educate people as much as we want to, and I think there have been educated areas. But until one realizes the level that the criminals involved in this are involved in, human trafficking, gun running, every form of drug you can think of, it's a huge criminal network. And I think until one can address that, and I'm not sure if we ever can, and that's why I sometimes wonder, is does one continue talking about the criminals, or does one start to rather look at the work that people like Marcus are doing and get that across to people and say, right, you know, we're not going to stop the criminals unless we can turn poacher into protector. And that's been done in some countries, and it's a huge issue. And, you know, when you listen to Marcus talk about the Kruger National Park and the issues surrounding that, and the socioeconomic issues around it, it's got those huge open borders. Remember, we're dealing with a reserve that has got the sort of the same border as the length of Israel. It's scary to try and deal with. So, you know, we can't guard each individual rhino. And to try and say to somebody coming across the border, we arrest a poacher, that's great, but hell, there are 10 more behind him, you know, looking for work. How do you change that? It's just too many people and too little opportunity.
Yeah. Director of Wildlife Conservation at the Network Rhino Recovery Fund, Dr. Marcus Hofmeyr, thank you so much for coming on to Weekend Breakfast.
My pleasure. And yeah, thanks for all the support you give to the people driving through the country early in the morning.
Thank you. That's Dr. Marcus Hofmeyr. Tim, it is a massive problem, and the tech that goes into this as well. When I'm talking about technology, Pelham Jones, he's also always been involved in this, and talking about night vision goggles and things like that. Are these still utilized? Are they still used?
Yeah, I think they are, Ray, and I think everything is, you know, it's the level of the work that these poor guys are doing. But again, as I say, they're fighting a losing battle. You used to go out, there was one poacher that you would try and arrest. Now you've got that one poacher and two or three guards that are working with the poacher. It's a military operation on both sides. And I think that's tremendously difficult to deal with.
Yeah, no, it most certainly is. Very quickly, Patricia de Lille and snakes in parliaments.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
What's that about?
Come on, guys. One of the villagers has got a lot of rats and frogs and now complaining about snakes. This is one of the parliamentary villagers. And what really fascinated me reading the article is, I'm sorry, Minister, please get better advisors than telling you that you're going to use snake repellent and tablets to get rid of the snakes. Get rid of the rats, madam. That was your first little port of call, because that's why your snakes are coming out, because there's lots of food around the houses, etc. Most probably the rats are the cause of the main issue. And there is no thing as a working snake repellent. Go and talk to people like Johan Marais of the African Snake Bite Institute, and they will educate you correctly.
I thought I would
get
just
better
ask
advisors.
You. Thank you. I thought I would just ask you, because it did seem a little bit bizarre to me. I snuck that one in there. A nature enthusiast, Tim Neary, good to have you back on 702, talking about rhino and talking quickly about snakes as well. That's another discussion for another day.